as the last IPCC special report showed. There's such a huge difference between 2 degrees, 3 degrees, 4 degrees. It's not linear. And there's such a difference between a half a meter of sea level rise and 1 meter or 2 meters or 4 meters, et cetera. So we're really talking about the magnitude of change, the rate of change, the scale of change, and this idea that, you know, we actually, like the reflection that we are actually creating these changes and that we can deliberately, collectively respond to the changes. I think it gives us this, you know, hope that, wow, we can actually limit global warming. But it is going to take a collective effort that is unprecedented.
That was the remarkable scientist and professor, Karen O'Brien, who, as one of the participating scientists in the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, was a co-recipient of the Nobel Peace Prize. In today's conversation, Karen and I will be exploring her current perspectives on the climate crisis and the potentials and nature of rapid social transformation. I can't wait for you to hear it. I'm Terry Patton, and this is State of Emergence. We are in a moment in the human journey that seems to confront us with utterly impossible challenges, and yet so much exciting, new innovation, new ways of being human, new ways of relating to one another, technological advances, social innovations are also at the very same time emerging. And all of us are being called by all of this to participate. Personally, relationally, and in terms of the redesign and transformation of the systems we live inside of. And that's what all of us here at this nonprofit called the New Republic of the Heart are dedicated to, newrepublicoftheheart.org. This podcast is a place to have public conversations that bridge different aspects of the leading edge of how human intelligence is arising in response to a collective existential emergency that is intended to help us nurture the emergence of a whole new human pattern. So before we dive in, please take a moment to subscribe so you automatically receive new episodes, or follow us on social media, or go to our website and give us your email address so that you are kept in the loop. Now, let's begin my conversation with Karen O'Brien. Well, I'm delighted to be joined today by Karen O'Brien. She's a professor in the Department of Sociology and Human Geography at the University of Oslo, Norway. And she's co-founded Sea Change, which is an initiative that supports transformation in a changing climate. She's worked for 30 years in the climate change research area, and yet, in a way that's not very typical in that field, she really brings a truly integral approach to explore and promote the deliberate transformations that are going to actually bring about sustainability. She doesn't view it in the narrow, reductive terms that so much of that field tends to. And she's looked at the role of creativity, collaboration, empowerment, narratives in adaptation and transformation processes, and even the role of paradigms in generating conscious social change. She participated in 4 of the IPCC reports, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, and as a part of the IPCC, was a co-recipient of the 2007 Nobel Peace Prize. And along with numerous academic articles, she's published, written, and co-edited numerous books, among them Globalization and Environmental Change, Double Exposures, with Robin Lichenko, with whom she also authored her most recent book, Climate and Society, Transforming the Future. But it's really as an inquiring soul, a really intelligent, well-informed, caring human being that I recognize, Karen, and want to be in public dialogue with you, Karen. So you're bringing a prodigious amount of understanding and intelligence and data and professional expertise, but you're not reducing yourself to some sort of abstracted mind. You're really showing up as a human being in a world that is in many ways seriously challenged and threatened. And as someone who has not lost her ability to use what I call her, I call it integral heart intelligence, in that it is absolutely everything that we have in terms of mental intelligence and even some visceral intelligence integrated as the best of our total human intelligence. And it's as a fellow inquirer in all those domains that I wanted to have this public conversation. So welcome and thank you.
Thank you, Terry. It's really a pleasure to be here, and I look forward to talking with you tonight.
Yeah, great. Well, I think it might be useful for us to begin with an address to, you know, the people who will listen to this will have many perspectives. There are intelligent people who have questions about the essence of climate science. There are many different perspectives that are brought to the conversation, and it might be helpful if you kind of look back at the years that you have spent in this field, and particularly your participation in the IPCC. Appreciating what you feel now is really valid and important about you and your colleagues' good work, but also accounting for why you're currently focusing in a different way.
Yeah, I'm not sure where to begin. Maybe when I first became interested in climate change, I had absolutely no background in science, and I was very interested in international diplomacy and peace. And it was the hot summer of 1988, and I was just starting graduate school, and I just, you know, I really wanted to learn everything I could about climate change. So I took lots of the physical science courses. I had a background in social sciences and international relations, and I just found it so fascinating to study climatology and meteorology and ecology and geography. And I became a geographer. A human geographer, and really, you know, was exploring what climate change meant for food security in Mexico, looking at the climate change models. And this was, you know, 30 years ago. So really starting to see, like, what are the implications of climate change for humans? And then I did my PhD dissertation on deforestation and climate change, and what does that mean for society? And so over the years, I've really looked a lot at, you know, the different dimensions of the problem, but more and more, and probably most passionately, at the social and the human dimensions of climate change. What does it mean for human security? How do we adapt to a changing climate? And more in the recent years, you know, how do we transform deliberately the risks and vulnerabilities that we're creating for ourselves? So I've been, you know, very much trying to look at it from so many different perspectives to try to kind of make sense of it for myself and others, especially in teaching. The Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change has been a really great experience for trying to pull together and synthesize, like, all the knowledge that we do have on particular topics. And I started with the adaptation chapter in the fourth assessment report. And it really opened my eyes to what we know and what we don't know about how society can adapt to a changing climate. So probably what really, you know, triggered a shift in my perspective was looking at the limits to adaptation, not just the barriers, but limits, like, what will we lose under different scenarios of climate change, and why does it matter? So that has been, you know, it was really, like, eye-opening to work with so many different people coming at climate change from so many different fields and so much different experience, but also, you know, just a deep commitment to really wanting to, like, put the puzzle pieces together and really try to articulate in a very clear way what we know, what we don't know, and why it matters.
You know, what comes up for me is, you know, I've seen you present on the essence of the science, which you understand pretty thoroughly. And one of the things that stood out for me in looking at that kind of presentation was just how seriously you and the other IPCC scientists took the charge to reason from evidence with care and not to make any careless leaps and to question every extrapolation and assumption. And so the rigor of the enterprise was really visible to me. And I just want to appreciate that and maybe give you a chance mm-hmm. to comment on it. But then I want to link that to a question, which is, you said it opened your eyes. You know, I'm sure that you could talk about that for hours on end, but maybe you could offer just a few sentences with the summary takeaways that came to you about the limits of our capacity to adapt.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that, you know, under different scenarios of climate change, you know, we will be facing losses just because of the physical changes and our lack of capacity to keep up, you know, institutionally to adapt. So it really is that, you know, at the end of the day, as temperatures get warmer and warmer, we really are exceeding our own capacity to, you know, to be outside in heat just because of the body's cooling mechanisms and systems. And many species will not be able to adapt to a changing climate. And we see that, you know, with biodiversity loss in and of itself is an enormous problem, but climate change just makes it so much worse. And we see that climate change is really like a threat multiplier for so many different aspects. And so I think, you know, where many people are saying, oh, we just need to adapt to a warming world, it became really clear that there is no science of adaptation to a, you know, 2 degree, 3 degree, 4 degree warmer world for many conditions and for many ecosystems. And so the risks are so high. And regardless, we are, you know, there are going to be things that we lose. So that becomes a real part of the, you know, adaptation, mitigation type of dichotomy, is like dealing with, you know, losses of things that we value.
You know, many of the people that will be listening to this are, for instance, informed by Jim Bendel's deep adaptation paper and the idea that we're headed for pretty much inevitable societal collapse. I mean, there's a very strong argument that we have, that the IPCC and scientists in general have systematically understated the severity of the implications of the science in order not to be viewed as overly alarmist, and that we are facing dystopia, if not extinction. And there are some people who are relating to that in ways that have a great deal of soul and depth and beauty. I don't think we can put them all in a single bucket. And there are some who are just becoming survivalists and, you know, kind of embittered and try to make it through. I mean, people are going in a lot of different directions. Some people are just going into despair. There's a lot of eco-psychological grief rituals, you know, just kind of grappling with the horrendous seeming implications of the climate science. And then other people who are really unwilling to go there, partly because it seems to sap their capacity to show up at their best. Just on a, hey, I don't want to go into those beliefs because of what I can see they do to me and to us. And I wonder how you're reflecting on that dimension of the public conversation right now.
Yeah, and this takes us back to the IPCC reports on, you know, the kind of the science of climate change, and this idea that that we still are, we have this window of opportunity where we can actually influence the climate system before we reach climate tipping points and before things become catastrophic. So it's a, you know, we do have the technologies, we do have the capacities to actually limit warming. And I think to, you know, to the people who are really, you know, grieving about this and kind of already living, you know, kind of living in the dystopian world that, oh, you know, all is forlorn right now. I think that, you know, it's like, wow, we can do so much better now. There's such a huge difference between 1.5 degrees and 2 degrees, as the last IPCC special report showed. There's such a huge difference between 2 degrees, 3 degrees, 4 degrees. It's not linear. And there's such a difference between 0.5 meter of sea level rise and 1 meter or 2 meters or 4 meters, et cetera. So we're really talking about the magnitude of change, the rate of change, the scale of change, and this idea that, you know, we actually, like the reflection that we are actually creating these changes and that we can deliberately, collectively respond to the changes. I think it gives us this, you know, hope that, wow, we can actually limit global warming, but it is going to take a collective effort that is unprecedented.
Yeah. Well, we want to mainly talk about that. Before I go there completely, I want to talk about the nature of certainty and uncertainty and the science, and bring forward that there are some pretty sophisticated and soulful challenges to the narrative that it's all about climate that is so pervasive. And I'm thinking particularly of Charles Eisenstein's recent book, Climate, A New Story, where he really argues that we have a tremendous ecological predicament and a trajectory of ecological destruction, and that our right relationship to it is one that is more evoked by recognizing that we're not really separate from the world around us, and that we have a kinship and a brother sisterhood with all living things, and our care for the lake, the forest, the marshland, a recognition that they are our fellow organs in a single body of life, and therefore that we care for them, and that perhaps the interpretation of the climate science abstracts us, you know, it's parts per million, and we're doing it with math, and maybe we can have big carbon sucking machines that will change things. And that orientation continues this story of separation, and that perhaps if we entered into a more profound, loving mutuality with all of the living earth, the results wouldn't necessarily be what people think we could predict from the abstract models of parts per million of carbon and degree of heat trapping and so forth that are the substance of the climate science. So he almost suggests we not believe in it too much, I guess. And I wonder how that strikes you.
Mm-hmm. Well, I haven't read his book, but I think I can see like that the strengths of those arguments, because I do think of climate change as a relationship problem. You know, it's really about how we relate to each other, how we relate to the environment, and how we relate to the future. But I think that, you know, like the you don't want to throw out the baby with the bathwater. The climate science has been so important in identifying patterns and trends and processes that we have to look at. And one of the dangers of that, though, is that we've tended to make it a climate problem or an environment problem and putting it in like a separate box rather than actually opening it up and seeing that, like, wow, this is about how we are relating to the atmosphere, the relationship between the biosphere and the noosphere and the hydrosphere, you know, all of these different dimensions. And the risk and danger with that is if we just respond to it in a very technical way, a very scientific way, that we start to, you know, just put all our emphasis on the technological changes, including possibly geoengineering the climate, which is what we're doing, you know, like changing the atmospheric composition so that we can manage it. And that kind of misses the, you know, misses the whole point of what that the real problem is, that deeper problem. So I agree with him that, you know, like that we have to really look at it as much more of a, you know, climate change as an entry point for looking at much more prevalent problems about how we have related to the biosphere, the atmosphere, and the environment in general. and then starting to, and to me, when I look at, when I focus on adaptation, it's not just adapting to the changes in climate change, but it's really adapting to the very idea that we are changing the climate, and that we are part of that climate system, and that we are related to this. And so getting, you know, to where he's, you know, his story, I think, is a really important part of the climate change narrative. And I think the science is really like, it's a powerful entry point because it's measurable, observable, and it's really hard to deny, you know, when you look at the numbers and the data.
Right. Except we do live in a world in which the complexity of the data is more than many people can hold in their attention. And there's a, as I mentioned, this narrative of collapse or extinction, and then there's clearly this narrative of denial that's still got so much cultural currency, particularly in the United States among people who have been voting Republican, you know, for this period of time. And we have a this polarization and maybe a breakdown in our relatedness across the red-blue divide. And I find myself, this is a completely, you know, inaccurate oversimplification, but it has a certain essential truth. 90% of people are in denial, and of the 10% that are facing the incredibly sobering realities of our situation, 90% of them have given up all hope. And so there are relatively few of us who recognize our dynamic, responsible, participatory opportunity. That there's some truth in that, I think. And it seems to me that coming alive in that at a new level, that's the truly integral move. And I think that's what your work is really intending to focus on and bring the rigor and credibility of the science that you know so well to that.
Yeah, I think that what it comes down to really is people realizing that they matter, that they are really making, you know, that we are actually making a difference. We are part of the same system that we're starting, you know, like that we're changing. And often, you know, you talk about the polarization, and polls are always coming out. Do you believe in climate change? Do you not believe in climate change? And it's really not about whether you believe in it, but it's really how you understand the climate system and our role in this system of, you know, the wider Earth system. And I think Earth system science in, you know, like showing us those connections between different processes and things has really given us, you know, we start to see patterns and trends and start to identify them. And it's really important because it starts to, you know, like there's a lot of things that pop up that we didn't know about before. You know, ocean acidification came, you know, when I started studying climate change, that wasn't on the agenda. And now all these potentials for tipping points that where you would actually create these irreversible changes in Earth systems processes, you know, the thermohaline circulation and, you know, all these like flows and things that we just kind of have taken for granted that this is the way things are. So, you know, to me, it's really, rather than asking people, do you believe in climate change? Are you skeptic or denial? It's like, well, how do you understand these systems and what do you think our role is? And when you start to realize that, you know, we actually do play a role in systems change, then you also open up for like, wow, we can change economic systems, we can change social systems, that we are actually quite powerful, not just as individuals, but as collectives. So to me, that opens up a whole new like inquiry into like, wow, how do we deliberately and consciously transform at the rate, scale, speed, and depth that is called for by the data that we are collecting around the world about, you know, ice sheets melting and temperatures increasing and ocean acidification. And not just that, but also species lost and, you know, plastic pollution and toxics in the environment. You know, like that it's really it's much, much bigger than climate change, what we're, you know, how we're relating to the environment as something separate and out there. So, you know, I think this relates to the work that you're interested in also. And, you know, how do we take this knowledge and create those cultural shifts, not just, you know, any kind of shift, but shifts to actually take care of the whole system and, you know, as to treat it as if we were one collective connected system.
Yeah. And how that feels and what it's like to be a human being in contact with another human being and as a caring feeling, living, breathing, vulnerable, sometimes frightened, sometimes courageous, you know, person with relations to people in the younger generations alive today and those yet to come. There's a kind of like if I were, I always sense actually that to the degree that I show up in a moment in a way that is informed by my years of spiritual practice and the awakening of intuitive freedom from the implications of all experience and fundamentally rested and happy and healthy, and yet also fully present to my place in this marvelous and miraculous living earth, which is so beautiful and for which I am so grateful, which feeds me so much and which I care about. And in that context, the fact that I'm alive at a time when things are sliding so rapidly toward destruction of so much that I love and that is really the support system for everything I appreciate in the human world, all the art and beauty and love and care and, you know, everything from cathedrals and symphonies to, you know, literature, everything that expresses what's best in the human spirit. And if I can come into contact with both the natural and the human worlds in a way that is recognizing that my middle class lifestyle is the thing that is eroded, you know, at one level, there's this horrific recognition. It is as if we are each one of billions of maggots, you know, halfway through devouring our host organism and now just beginning to catch an image of ourselves in the mirror. And there's a kind of horror and shame and guilt that tend to arise and an emotional reaction to that. And you know, we innocently did this. And so this self-negativity somehow isn't healthy at some other levels. We need to find our way to a right relationship that's a feeling relationship. I'm bringing in emotions because it seems to me that it's when I'm really rooted in that feeling relationship to all of it, the natural world, the human world, myself, my own contradictions, that I'm sufficiently humble and connected to others to have a conversation that invites forward all of what's best in them as well, and that something more fruitful maybe comes then.
Yeah, no, that's beautiful, because I think maybe your next book should be Climate Change as a Spiritual Practice, because it, you know, really, I think it demands a lot of us. It demands us to hold a lot of, you know, mixed emotions. And I think, you know, most people, I say, oh, are you optimistic or pessimistic? And I think many people are just, you know, on that line, depending on, you know, what they've read in the news, where they're, how they're feeling emotionally. But I do think that, you know, like the emotional part is probably the most like the dramatic thing that we have to address. And I think that there's many traditions like Vipassana meditation where, you know, to deal with things with equanimity and to be present for it and being able to just kind of like hold again, like what we're dealing with, but also to know that we can actually influence, you know, right here and now, that it's not a problem for 2030, for 2050, or for 2100, but that we are actually influencing the future right now. And we can colonize the future with all our dystopian thoughts and our values and things like that, but it really, you know, it does, you know, again, you know, we matter. And I think that we matter much more than we think because we are connected, because we aren't separate from anything else, and to open up to those emotions and feelings that you talk about, I think it widens that space for responding to something that could otherwise be quite overwhelming and lead to, you know, very much to despondency and despair.
Now, you've focused in by bringing what I think is, you know, the most fully articulated and fully understood and truly integral approach to climate understanding, but I think climate understanding because of its severity, or you know, the its apocalyptic or you know semi-apocalyptic implications, it isn't just understanding. It always becomes action, or you know, how can I help? How can I make a positive difference? And one of the ideas that you've brought forward that I think is useful, that I want to invite you to lay out, is the three spheres of transformation model. It's a simple way of bringing together some things that, you know, people tend to leave one or more of those spheres out of their conversations way too often. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and I'd love to talk about that because and it's very much inspired by my work with Dr. Monica Sharma, who I read an article about 10 years ago, From Personal to Planetary Transformation. And it really resonated with what I thought of as this very integral approach that you know goes much deeper. And so what she calls a conscious full spectrum of response in the context of climate change, you know, I was looking at it the practical sphere of those, you know, technical responses and behavioral changes that we really, you know, that are measurable, the things that we tend to be focusing most of our attention on. And they really are like right at the heart of those three spheres, you know, three concentric circles. And so we call that the practical sphere, but it really is influenced very much by what we call the political sphere, which are the systems and the structures, you know, the social norms, rules, regulations, institutions, the way that we have collectively organized society. And I don't mean political in just the sense of political parties, but really how we collectively are working, you know, are together. And it's a political sphere also because it's, you know, it's where we face that polarization of different goals for that practical sphere, different ways of wanting to organize the way we address resources, relate to water, relate to air, relate to everything. And it's also where we get the social movements where people, you know, show up and say, no, we want something different. And often in that political sphere, we can just get paralyzed and stuck for decades, you know, trying to come to an agreement to just limit global warming voluntarily, as we did with the Paris Agreement in 2015. And that's because we're what we call the outer sphere is the personal sphere, which is the individual and collective beliefs, values, worldviews, and paradigms through which we actually, you know, how we view the system, how we view ourselves in relation to the system, what we prioritize for the goals of the system. And you know, the real point is that it's not about changing people's beliefs, values, and worldviews and putting them, you know, in the practical sphere, like objects to be changed, but really working with those different perspectives and worldviews in that political sphere, but also reflecting on our own beliefs and assumptions and paradigms and things to kind of think about, you know, what are our individual and collective blind spots. And I think that's what's really coming out is very important. And now, what are we missing that we're, you know, maybe people 100 years from now will look back and go, wow, they couldn't see that they were connected. They couldn't see that, you know, even weeds had value. Oh, couldn't they see at, you know, there'd be so many things that we just took for granted, because that's often the way, you know, we look back in history and go, wow, what were they thinking? And I think that's, you know, the three spheres, you know, they're always interacting. They're always there. And yet, in the practical
terms.
Can
you repeat them again really systematically? So it's.
Yeah. The practical, the political, and the personal spheres. Yeah, so there are three very, you know, so, yeah, there are many people.
Well, go ahead. I want you to complete.
Yeah. Many people would say, oh, the personal sphere should be in the center, almost like the little brain. But I think that it's so pervasive. It's so, you know, it influences, if you look at leverage points for systems change, it's often the paradigms, the goals of the system, you know, the things that are very subjective that influence how we organize politically and the very practical solutions that we come up with.
So when I think of personal, I first come to the ways that I'm painfully aware that my own daily activities are, you know, I live in a place where you can't really get around without a car, and I've cut way back on my air travel and so forth, but I haven't made a firm decision to never fly again or anything, you know, and I won't. My son lives across the country. And And so that this paying attention to my own carbon footprint is something I'm doing. And yet I'm also aware that I somehow have to stay caring and paying attention to my own behavior, but also try to be effective in terms of systems change. And it's not going to matter so much what I do personally if the world itself and all kinds of systemic and policy levels that are more political or international in nature, or even some technological advances, don't change the dynamic themselves. And then I also, when I think about practical, I guess I'm tending to think about conversion to carbon neutral energy systems and transportation systems and food systems and things like that. But I think maybe when you're saying personal, you're going to the place that I end up taking things. You're not so much talking about the carbon footprint. Maybe that's in the practical mm-hmm. category. You're talking about my very way of being and my own maturation and development and the changes in my relationships with others and the paradigms out of which we understand the world. Am I?
Absolutely, yes. Because it really is, our daily, our social practices are very much in the practical and the political spheres, So whether you have access to, you might be easy to tell you to ride a bicycle, but if you don't have bike lanes and access to showers at work and things like that, it makes it very difficult in that practical and political. But often the things that are barriers to change are very much like in our head, if I don't eat meat, I will, this will happen. Or if I ride my bicycle, this will happen. Or, so it's a little bit like that, those practical changes that we need to make are often, we need to organize society differently. We need different incentives and think the structures have to be in place to make it so that we can organize ourselves collectively in that way. And I think that, that relationship between individual change and collective change and systems change is very much where my research is focusing on right now, because it's not just to say that it doesn't matter what I do because we need systems change, but we are the systems, And so as we talk about it, as we demand changes in systems, as we choose different types of things that, the system is constantly responding to what we're doing, what we're talking about, et cetera. So I think it's, there's a danger in individualizing climate change and just reducing it down to people's, your own individual carbon footprint. And can you offset that without actually looking at the, power structures and interests that continue to invest in fossil fuels, that continue to, devastate forests and soils, et cetera. So how do we, to be able to see that, we are all systems shifters, we can all shift cultures, and to really give ourselves a much bigger role than what we're, than just sorting our trash or doing this. And I think that's where the, the both and comes in, because that we have to be able to see ourselves, the multiple roles that we play.
I so appreciate who Karen is, that she remains a serious and rigorous scientist, and in a very uncomplicated way is also a very human, caring, emotionally connected human being. And her response to the science and her way of communicating the knowledge helps us to recognize that these silos of different specialization are superficial to what unites us all in our humanity. It's really telling that her extensive knowledge and experience with the data and the research and her poignant awareness of the enormity and severity of the challenge have led her to a focus on an integral approach to rapid social transformation and a recognition of the potentials for that. So I'm really excited that we're going to be able to plunge deeper and look into even quantum approaches to social science. So if you appreciate this, I hope you'll feel inspired to share this. We want these conversations to build a community dedicated to these inquiries. And if you've been finding this whole podcast of value, we hope you'll become a member and contributor. We're a very lean nonprofit organization, mostly volunteers, but there are some significant ongoing costs to producing the show and some roles that should at least be modestly compensated. So your support can make a really important impact. If enough people just come in and contribute even a small amount, just $5 or $10 a month, it all adds up and it'll help make this podcast able to continue. So I hope you'll consider it as you listen. Thank you so much to all of you who are already contributing. And now, back to my conversation with Karen O'Brien. It does seem to me that the focus on the systemic change is correct analytically, that we need systemic change on a very, very broad level if we're going to really grapple with this problem. But I also notice that people who are focused on that and who let that kind of give them a get out of jail free card relative to their own behaviors are somehow missing an aspect of the spiritual practice that that climate change involves. Because there's something about this recognition that we were born into a system that, in some sense, we're the luckiest people who ever lived, and we've had so much privilege, and we have contact with all the knowledge and science and wisdom of all human cultures throughout time in dialogue in a whole different way. And yet we are the very thing that is potentially bringing to an end the living earth that is our context and our deepest relation and our everything we love, you know, is interwoven with. And so there's a weird thing where on the moral, like, I want to take it seriously morally, and yet most conventional moral equations would draw me to a place of shame or horror or guilt that are disempowering and inappropriate. We did helplessly find ourselves in a world system that was not self-aware. I mean, yes, to some degree, there was something patriarchal and objectifying, and, you know, there is a story that some people tell, essentially, that it was the white Christian European cultures who had this more separated worldview and which conquered the world and colonized and is therefore, you know, guilty of a sin. Mm-hmm. And yet somehow that, I do think that there's something of like having a repentance and a reunion with what we have lost connection with that is really important to our growth. But there's also something of a kind of general amnesty that's also a necessary ingredient in a right relationship to these things. What do you think of that?
Well, I think like going back to what you're talking about with Charles Eisenstein's new climate story, systems are relationships. You know, they're relationships of things that we, you know, conceive of as making up a bigger whole. And I think that, you know, like when we start to realize that we're always in relation to a system, and we can actually be part of continuing that system, or we could actually be part of transforming that system. And that, going back to the emotions and things, you know, now there's a lot of things about like flight shaming, if you're, you know, and it's having an effect on, you know, people's air travel and everything. But to, you know, shame is also something that a lot of people don't want to feel. So like, oh, how, you know, it's not always helpful to make people feel ashamed to fly when they have to get somewhere when we don't have the train infrastructure in place yet, or it's four times more expensive, or things. And so it's like that tension between, you know, saying like, oh, maybe we can, you know, like we're doing this by video, which is, you know, fantastic because neither of us has to fly around the world. And so there are hundreds of more solutions to climate change than we're actually, like, when you reduce it to just a CO2 problem or greenhouse gas emissions, you kind of narrow, like, oh, this, you turn yourselves into carbon you know, a carbon footprint, rather than seeing like what is your, you know, your social handprint, or how can you actually have that, you know, influence those bigger systems so that you can actually reduce gigatons of carbon, but also, you know, create a, you know, a world where we do respect other species, other people, other, you know, like other ways of being. And I think that that's the, you know, like that is that the challenge, the adaptive challenge that we're really facing, you know. So it's not, you know, like the technical dimensions of the problem are things that are, you know, we tend to be relatively good with everything, but it really is those, you know, challenging our own assumptions about the way the world is organized and the way it has to be and what we need, what we don't need. And it opens up like a much, like the inquiry, I think, has to go much wider and much deeper if we want to actually get to the types of solutions that will, you know, get away from like shaming people and finger pointing and saying, oh, you're bad, and really like activating that sense of agency that we actually can change, that what you do, you know, what you eat, that does actually matter. And especially when you start to, you know, like not tell other people about it, but you start to share stories and start to relate to change in a different way. And so going back to our earlier discussion about the IPCC, and, you know, like at one point I really realized in working on these reports that a lot of the literature that was inspiring me was the literature on change rather than on climate. And so that I think that that's really where we need to focus right now, is how do we deliberately transform, and how do we, you know, like change the change. And then so it goes way outside the climate box.
Right. Yeah. Way. You know, in bringing that up, I want to go to maybe what I think is one of the most exciting aspects of what I hope we can talk about today, which is you've written a really interesting article on quantum social science and the sort of the interrelations of what we know about quantum theory and social science and how that relates to rapid societal transformation. And some of my own work comes into play in relation to that. So I'd love to give you a chance to inform people about the fundamental points that emerge from looking at social science in a quantum context and the potentials for rapid societal transformation.
Yeah, it's hard to explain it briefly, but I think that, you know, like what intrigues me about that is to, you know, that some social scientists are starting to say, like, if we had to reinvent the social sciences today, it wouldn't necessarily be based on this kind of classical Newtonian physics of atomism, reductionism, determinism. It would be much more inspired by quantum physics, which is showing us uncertainty, potentiality, entanglement, etc. And so there's a, you know, more and more people are starting to just use either just the algorithms from quantum physics, or the metaphors, or actually the meanings of it to look at how, you know, how are we relating to each other in society. And this goes back to this idea that if you think of ourselves as just like one large system that is entangled and related and things like that, you would tell a different story about ourselves. And I think that what fascinates me, of course, you know, people have been saying this for thousands of years through many different indigenous knowledge systems and groups and things, but knowing that, like, you know, the physical science has a lot of power in determining both the problem and the solution space for dealing with climate change. And so I think that if we start to, you know, say like, well, what if we are actually underestimating our collective capacity for social change, you know, that reality not being, you know, what it seems at the subatomic or, you know, microscopic level, you know, suddenly it's like, what if in terms of, you know, the social, if our, you know, through language, through, you know, stories, through meaning, through consciousness itself, that we are actually, you know, that we see ourselves as connected, that we see ourselves as a collective, as both individuals and collectives, waves and particles, et cetera. I think there's a lot to be said for just, you know, challenging our thinking rather than waiting 100 years or 150 years to say, like, you know, I mean, they say now, you know, sense of smell is quantum, photosynthesis is quantum. There is no barrier between the, you know, quantum and classical worlds. It's just our ways of of, you know, like what washes out at certain levels. So I think that, you know, the ideas that, you know, like that social change may be actually able to happen much faster than we think if we just start to like just switch the way we think about ourselves in relation to each other and the world, and really get it at a deep level that we do matter. And I mean that literally in the physical sense, that we are constantly here and here and here mattering, but also collectively.
You know, we've seen some pretty dramatic and positive developments with the rapid growth and influence of Extinction Rebellion in the UK and the declaration of a climate emergency by the Parliament there, and the enormous impact of Greta Thunberg's trip to the United States and her speech at the UN General Assembly. And there is a rapid shift, but it's not enough for people to change their attitudes. We are dealing with something, you know, climate change is sometimes called a hyper object. That is, our idea of it never captures all of what it is, that it's essentially almost incomprehensible to us because of its multidimensionality. And therefore, our conversation is always not quite adequate to what it is. And therefore, as soon as we begin to have some successes in the attitudinal changes that are rapid, the enormity of what it is to have the kind of holistic, rapid social transformation that is really necessary begins to come into view. And we really see the enormity of what the design specs of the situation really require.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and the people who work on social practices are, you know, very critical of the attitude, behavior, and choice model, that, you know, it's up to the individuals and their changes in attitudes. Because, you know, as we just talked about, it really is about, you know, shifting systems, shifting power relationships, shifting norms. And, you know, the way we organize society right now really is the, you know, it's an outcome of a different, you know, different thought patterns and different ideas of what, you know, different values and goals and things. And so if we can, you know, really start to, right here where we're at right now in 2019, start to think about, you know, what needs to shift, what's not working for us to get to a place where, you know, where we can all thrive. And I think anyone who is just starting to think that, you know, we can have a world that is sustainable for some but not all, really, you know, isn't seeing that the, you know, like, isn't understanding the systemic nature of climate change and the fact that, you know, like, that we're, you know, the connections are so deep. And we, you know, we are so far away from actually understanding how to, you know, deal with, like, people who are displaced from their homes, you know, and to deal with the, you know, like the challenges for food security, for health security, for water security, and everything. And a lot of that is very social. You know, it's about how we organize ourselves socially, what, you know, what type of, you know, how we...
Well, yeah, I mean, you're talking about those in broad categorical terms, but what that reduces to in human experience is huge waves of climate migrants and people wanting to throw up walls in order not to have them all wash in, and the potential of us being dehumanized by our attempt to keep islands of privilege in the midst of a human world that's degenerating, and so forth. And you know, who are we morally, and how are we, you know, there. And yet the terms in which we have the conversations are even the best of the terms in which we're currently having the conversations will continue to have to evolve, because the implications of the entanglement of all these different dimensions of our lives and experience are actually something we're still growing in our capacity to even understand and see.
I think that there's a tendency also for us to think about, like, climate change is going to be affecting those others, and those others will be coming across the border and things. But it's really about, it will affect all of us. And, you know, we're talking about cities in the United States, small islands on the Atlantic coast that are already starting to think about, should we stay or should we go? And, you know, cities on the coast in Norway where flooding, you know, that, like, where it's built right along the fjords and things. And so it's not... you know, like, it's really like to come to terms with, like, systems shift, and it's not just, you know, out there for others. And so it is a, you know, to actually be thinking about how are we going to organize society in a change. And that goes back to adaptation. And some people talk about transformative adaptation. You know, how do we move cities of millions of people as sea level rises? How do we translocate species so that they can be in different areas? How do we start to, you know, really think about, you know, getting water to places that will not have water? And we're seeing that now. And that's, again, probably, you know, more dramatically than many scientists thought decades ago. And yet it calls attention to then, you know, what type of institutions have we set up? What type of ethics are we going to build this around? How are we going to, you know, be dealing with a world in dynamic change, recognizing that we are creating the risks that we're responding to right now? And so it's a, you know, it's truly a hyper object, but it is also one that we have to really, you know, take seriously, because if we just keep pushing it off and saying we'll deal with it after the next event or the next, we'll just be constantly reacting rather than, you know, really creating that world we want to live in right now.
Well, that's very real to me. I live in an area that is, I had a cabin that burned in the Valley Fire 3 years ago, and many friends who lost everything. And I was choked with smoke last year terrifically. This is a mild fire year, and still my nephew was evacuated and I lost power and all that. We're it's not distant to me at all. What is coming up for me as a, I feel like I have an obligation to the next seven generations to try to be the change that needs that cares and that responds to and addresses their well-being. And I don't really altogether have a simple method that is adequate to the full complexity of the challenge, because you've outlined just how profound this entanglement is. So what I'm tending to want to do is to create smaller communities, and this can be a nonprofit organized around some activist agenda, or it could be a community, a spiritual practice community, a sangha or an ashram. It could be, or a church, you know, probably more often, you know, a congregation, or it can be a community of practice that recognizes itself as being both spiritual and activist in its nature, that is a way and trying to grow together to be the change we know we need to see in the world. And in attempting to prototype ways of being as individuals and in our ways of relating to one another that are at another paradigm, that are models for what might be adequate to the world ahead, we might learn some things that can be shared, and that therefore we're doing research, that this is action research. You try to do it, you never could possibly succeed completely, but you have some successes and you also can measure some of the ways that you're falling short. And so your prototype can then be revised and you iterate. And then in this action learning, you get closer and closer to getting something right. And if many of us attempt this, and if we share our learnings with one another, a field of intentional cultural evolution, learning by doing, begins to emerge. And some of those best practices can be good enough that they might scale relatively rapidly. At least that's my theory of change. And that this idea of quantum social science, it's more than an idea. It's almost like a budding field, as you've begun to bring it forward, is a really important idea, legitimizing something about this sort of strategy or theory of change that has been animating my own efforts. And I want to invite you to comment on that and perhaps critique what I'm suggesting or observe or add to it in whatever ways seem relevant.
And I think that's great, because I think also in an entangled world, many people are actually doing that, you know, activating, living in a different paradigm, and living with like values that a different value system that are the values that apply to everyone: equity, compassion, dignity. You know, like really trying to be that change through what you call the action research. But these, you know, what I would call like fractals, or Monica Sharma's work would be fractals, and I would call them quantum fractals, because we are entangled with others through language, through meaning. So it's almost like that these, you can't see, like social change itself is like this nonlinear process. And we might be this close to that tipping point of, you know, the social tipping point, when all these different things around the world bubble up, and then suddenly people, you know, just wake up and go like, oh, yeah, why did we do that? You know, why did we burn fossil fuels? It's such, hydrocarbons are so valuable, you know, for, you know, the next thousands of years. Why did we burn them? Oh, why did we, you know, like, why did we put poisons on our food? Why did we do this and that? And so I think that that, you know, that model is like, it's coming from so many people, and especially young people, you know, that are just, you know, they're connecting the dots in ways that like I didn't when I was their age, and they're seeing things. And they're also saying that, you know, like when you start to present that like, oh, the future is lost, they're saying like, you know what? No, we're going to do it anyway. And there's a lot of this, you know, real sense of, climate justice, a sense of potential that, you know, unrealized potential, and almost, you know, we have no choice. And that's, again, you know, like, so from in research, I think it's not a question of like, can we limit warming to 2 degrees? I think it's like, how do we limit warming to 2 degrees? And how do we do it in an ethical, equitable, and sustainable way? You know, how do we take all the knowledge that we have and then put it into practice as you're defining, you know, because I think that's really the exciting part, is to actually live these changes and then see what we learn, because it's going to be iteration after iteration and new problems will emerge. But as we increase our capacity to, you know, address complex problems, you know, we're going to have many more and everything. But I think with climate change, it kind of gets us, you know, like it adds a sense of, you know, limited time span and urgency to really get it right. So I think that's the, you know, if you take climate change science seriously, you have to take social change seriously as well, and start to think like, yeah, how can we create these new patterns, and, you know, at a scale.
What are the signs or indications or experiments? Are there some specific projects or approaches that are especially heartening to you that are specific emergence that are a source for your hope and optimism in the midst of things that you'd like to share?
Well, as a, you know, I'm teaching younger people, and I think that like, just that gives me a lot of hope, because they're, you know, sometimes they just shake their head. That's not the way we're thinking anymore. And they're really, you know, they're passionate about wanting to, you know, like, engage with transformative change and to do something. And, you know, they're, you know, some of them are wondering whether, do I stay in school or do I become active now? And some are joining the Extinction Rebellion, some are going on strikes, but some are really, you know, really doing exactly what you're talking about, is launching the alternatives, creating things that didn't, you know, like kind of rattling the system by, you know, not getting driver's licenses, or just saying that, nah, we don't even want to be part of that old paradigm anymore. And so it's not really about like shifting the paradigm, but it's really about like being the new paradigm. And I see that that's, you know, it's kind of all over the place. That, you know, I was just in Chile for a transformations conference, and really, you know, hearing just how, and this was right about the time that the unrest was coming. So we were talking about how important equity is, how important it is to actually shift those systems and structures. But you saw so many examples from everywhere. People really get it, you know, school teachers, and, you know, everyone really, you know, deep down gets that, that connection, the importance of actually, you know, shifting towards a equitable and thriving world. So I see that a lot is actually happening, and that it is like, how do we actually create the conditions where these changes can really, you know, bubble up, rather than just going out there and trying to change everybody.
Are there some things, you know, as I was articulating my own sense of strategy, I'm imagining, you know, yes, this thing that is happening everywhere and bubbling up and growing through the cracks in the sidewalk everywhere you turn, are the expression of this new field of action research, learning by doing, attempting to be the next paradigm. And how can that field become self-aware and everybody learn from each other better? Are there some practices or initiatives along those lines that come to mind. You know, you're a scientist, and here we're talking about a different kind of science, not the abstract learning of principles and then later putting it into action, but the let's try it and iterate it, keep getting better at it as we go and learning from each other. What might we do that would further that most?
Well, there's a whole field of action research and a network of action research led by Hillary Bradbury. And, you know, it really is kind of going beyond research as usual and, you know, saying that, yeah, we have to come in self-aware. And even within the global change research, there's much more emphasis now on co-design, co-production of knowledge, that it's no longer this, you know, like that we just stay in our heads and we just deliver knowledge to power and, you know, whatever. It's more that like this, like deliberative, participatory, you know, even like community-based adaptation has, you know, there's so much that the, you know, the paradigm is shifting in so many ways, but we're again realizing that we are not separate. You know, you don't go in and do research and stand separate from it. You're always doing action research in a connected, entangled system. And so to be really self-aware about it and to, you know, reflect and to, you know, to share, to, you know, you start to see that this is happening everywhere. And there's researchers who are really looking at what they call like bright spots of the good Anthropocene, the things that are happening all over the place and trying to really like do that type of inventory. Because when you read the news, most newspapers, you just hear about the catastrophes and the negative things that are happening. And you don't really get the, you know, the thousands of positive things. And, you know, the Paul Hawkins Drawdown Project, or the Project Drawdown has led to drawdown groups around the world that are really exploring a much wider range of solutions. So I don't, you know, want to, I was like, oh, I'm so optimistic, but it is really that my fear is that we really are underestimating the capacities and the potential that is right here and that is being activated by so many people. You know, we're kind of like stuck in this old, like, you know, like it just still comes up. Do you believe in climate change? Do you not believe in climate change? That's really like just the wrong question, because it's like, how do we create a thriving world deliberately and consciously? And so, so I think there is, you know, I think many more people are engaged and involved than we actually think.
Beautiful. Well, Karen, I hope we'll have some more dialogues on this, because we've gotten into such fruitful territory. I want to thank you, and maybe give you an opportunity. Those seemed almost like concluding statements, but if there's anything else that you'd like to say before we complete, I want to give you a chance.
Yeah, no, I just want to thank you, because it's been, I think these type of dialogues are so important, because I think, and I think many people need to have them, because in some ways, a lot of the despair and despondency is because of a lack of seeing other possibilities existing. And so if we can, you know, get people talking about what really matters to them and why, and to, you know, put themselves not just as the problem in climate change, but as the solution. And when we start to think of people as the solutions to climate change, then we think like, wow, that's really powerful. You know, it's a lot. And I guess that's that idea of activating our individual agency, our collective agency, our political agency, you know, really, you know, just, you know, like, just taking this seriously. And I think it's, you know, it's happening regardless, but it's like, what role do we want to play in it? And I think everyone has a bigger role than they think to play in these shifts that are going on.
Yeah. I know that people often go through a dark night of the soul as they face the incredibly sobering realities of the whole ecological emergency, but where I'm hanging out and where the people I'm working with are hanging out is in the ways in which we feel inspired. And you've really given us a lot to, you know, a scientific rationale, because sometimes people just intuitively sense that they want to be oriented more positively, but there's a lot of logic behind it, and you've really bolstered us with everything you've shared today. And I'm really grateful. It's been as it always is when we talk, it's been a real pleasure.
Yeah, thank you so much. It's been really a pleasure to talk to you, and I look forward to continuing the conversation, because it really is an ongoing inquiry, and it probably will never end.
Yeah, exactly so. Well, thank you so much for joining this rich conversation with us today. And you can dive further into this conversation by visiting stateofemergence.org and clicking on this episode for links and resources. These conversations are our attempt to go as deep as we can into many different aspects of what's most urgent now. And we want to learn about what's most useful to you, how these things are landing, so we can keep learning how to make what we do more and more useful, more and more valuable. And you can offer us that feedback by going to our website and subscribing to our email updates, and we'll be reaching out soon to all our listeners, inviting your feedback. And for those of you who feel aligned with these conversations and appreciating the way they're helping us enact a new human culture, I want you to feel invited to join our amazing international community called Living in a New Republic of the Heart. We're an inspired online community of change agents and spiritual practitioners who meet online regularly to explore, to practice, and to synergize our own consciousness and our efforts on behalf of the future of life. It's a really exciting and collaborative community that is working on the very edge, attempting really to bring about a whole field of these kinds of social experiments. If you'd like to learn more or get involved, go to newrepublicoftheheart.org or our podcast website, stateofemergence.org. I know many of you are part of a community or several communities that is, in one way or another, trying to be the change more fully and effectively. So this whole field of experimentation, learning by doing, is arising. And this is one of the legitimate theories of change, that we get something right in a small group, we get it right enough, and it can go viral and really spread. So this is something we're hoping to serve, and if you want to help us do that, please join us. I also want to turn to the people who are not so visible here, but who are really making this happen. State of Emergence is made by Mason Ewald, Lou Judson, Kristen Knoth, David Chasteen, Angela Murphy, and Siobhan McClory. A special thanks to a few of our founding backers and advisors who've helped fund and guide the launch of this podcast. Jeff Salzman, Roger Walsh, Craig Hamilton, Claire Zammit, Benjamin DePaul, Fred Clark, Curtis Pelly, Olivier Brockenmeyer, and music in State of Emergence was created by Asa Adoni, Adam Collette, and Walking Shoe. We are living together in a state of emergence.